This podcast contains mature themes and situations. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, this is Mark Yoshimoto Nemkov, author of Number One with a Bullet, Diary of a Madman, and the new all-ages podcast adventure novel Transistor Rodeo, which you can find at my blog, wordsushi.com. But now, what you've been waiting for, episode 13 of Murder at Avedon Hill with P.G. Holyfield.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, the Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hi, everybody. Thanks for returning to another episode of Murder at Avedon Hill. I hope everyone had a great holiday season. And I truly hope you enjoy 2008, which, for me, will definitely be the year of Avedon Hill. First of all, I want to thank some guest voices that contributed to the success of last episode. I got some great feedback on episode 12, especially the last 5 minutes or so, where a particular character appears and is treated less than hospitably by our possible murderer. First, thanks to Tabitha and her crew over at Buffy Between the Lines. A few weeks ago, I pinged Tabs and asked her if she and the Between the Lines cast would like to voice some of the echoed voices you heard in episode 12. They did a great job, and if you are a fan at all of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, head on over to BuffyBetweenTheLines.com and check out the wonderful work they are doing over there. I also want to thank Laura Ross from the Rocky Horror Pod Show and from the Coffee and Tea Show, Wander Wolf from the Wander Radio Podcast, and to Astral Guardian from the Astral Audio Experience podcast. The evening I released episode 12, these fine folks answered the call and gave me some quick audio so I could finish the episode. Great work, guys. Now, for this episode, we have the return of two podcast authors to Murder at Avedon Hill. First is T. Morris, appearing once again as Father Joris. Next, we have Matthew Wayne Selznick, reprising his role as Gareth Beckwin. We also have my friend James Cecil making his second appearance as the innkeeper, Talek Bor. One more item before we get to the story so far. I have opened a call line for Murder at Avedon Hill, what I've named the Cairn line for now at least. I'm using Grand Central as my voice line, and I think it's pretty cool. You can contact me in two ways. First, you can call 704-315-5884 and leave a message directly. And for those of you that don't like memorizing phone numbers, you can go to the MAAH website and click on the Call Me button. Here you can enter the phone number you want Grand Central to call, and boom, your phone will ring, and you can leave your comments. Let me know what you think about the podcast and the story, and once I get a few comments, I'll post a bonus listener episode. So that's it for the intro babble. Thanks to the Parsec Award-winning Mark Yoshimoto Nemkov for his intro bumper, and now it's time for the story so far. Previously on Murder at Avedon Hill.
Ho, good sirs. Welcome to the Avedon Hill Inn. Talek Bor, innkeeper, at your service.
Gareth Beckwin laughed.
I'm playing my part as well, Ari, to keep you on the path.
Aramis closed his eyes, knowing it didn't matter if his eyes were open or not. For Gareth Beckwin wasn't really there.
It's been a while. What, a year?
Don't ask me, Ari. You are the one who has conjured me.
You should come out to the cemetery tonight.
Father Joris flared his nostrils.
There is something in the air.
Tonight, we sleep.
You'd better take shifts sleeping if you aren't with me.
I will take that under advisement, Father Joris.
The voice. Not mine, is it? Isn't it?
The nothing is replaced with skin peeling from flesh. The voice she now knows is not hers speaks to her through the pain. Now we talk.
No.
The pain overwhelms the nothing in an instant.
Oh, how could I be so wrong?
Episode 13 of Murder at Avedon Hill. Chapter 13, To Sleep. The Icon of Kaylee, Child of Magic. Dreams are the passage between day and night, between Cairn and Callan's Abyss, between the land and the river. High Priest Kalan, the sisters of Kaylee. Following his bath, Aramis, fully dressed for action if needed, stood at the only window in their room. From the window, Aramis could look out over the town in a northerly direction. The moon, nearly full for the first time this lunas, allowed Aramis to see much of the lower half of town, including the town circle, even smoke rising from the bakery and from several nearby homes. To the east of the inn, Aramis saw some small structures he and Aaron had not yet visited. They appeared to be small, one-room homes, but the weeds and grasses hid any paths that might lead to the area. Far in the distance, at the top of a rise, Aramis could make out the faintest outline of the town's cemetery. He was sure Father Joris was at the cemetery by now, as it was well past last bells. Even now, years removed from living in a major town or city, Aramis instinctively sensed when the temple bells should be rung. He attributed this to being more attuned to the land and its cycles than most. Temples dedicated to Aj and his 10 children could be found throughout Cairn, and despite their various differences, all had the same rules concerning bells. 4 sets of bells were rung daily. The bells of dawn, worship bells rung 2 psykes after the bells of dawn, signifying the start of organized worship rituals at most temples. Bells of dusk, and last bells rung 4 psykes after the bells of dusk. The bells of dawn and the bells of dusk were not rung at the moment of sunrise and sunset each day. One of the great achievements of the priests of Cairn was the development of a water-driven time mechanism that allowed temples across Cairn to ring the 4 common bells at exactly the same time. In addition, each child of Aj, and Aj himself, has his or her own special songs, rung weekly, or on special holy days throughout the seasons of the year. Even though Lord Avedon had given the order to cease bell ringing at the town's temple, Aramis heard last bells in his mind when they should have been rung. He hoped he would have the opportunity to actually hear the bells before they left Avedon Hill. As Father Joris had stated, Avedon Hill's temple to Aj had a grand set of bells. Comforted by the lack of movement on the town streets, Aramis decided it would be safe to return to the inn's common room. since the inn was the only business open after sundown. Aramis wondered if anyone might be visiting, possibly sampling Talic's ale. He double-checked the lock on the window, and then performed another thorough search of the room's walls and floor. He may not have been a cutpurse, like his ironic advisor mentor Drona Tublade had been during his youth, but Aramis felt safe that no one could access the room without using the room's only door. And to get to that door, one would have to pass through the inn's common room. Aramis made his way downstairs and found nothing but empty tables, save for one. In the back corner, he saw two men sitting at a booth, Cletus and Talic Bor. Aramis walked to their booth. Talic did not notice Aramis's approach. Only after Cletus ticked his head to his left, towards Aramis, did Talic realize that the monk stood by their table. Talic jumped to his feet and bowed slightly.
"I'm so sorry, Sir Aramis. I thought you had gone to bed. Is there anything you need? An ale, perhaps?"
I guess I can afford one more ale this evening, Talic." Talic raised his hands in alarm.
"Oh no, Sir Aramis. There is no need to talk about affording here. Lord Abaddon sent word you are to be taken care of. Your stay here, along with food and drink, is at no charge."
Aramis sat down in the place vacated by Talic moments earlier. "In that case, bring both Cletus and I an ale, and another bowl of that stew." Cletus, eating one of the largest plates of food Aramis had ever seen, shook his head no, and then let out a large belch. Talic gathered up three empty flagons from in front of Cletus.
"No, Sir Monk. I don't need another ale this evening. I have to get back to the town gate soon." "Who is watching it now?" "Constable Tanner is out there now. I get a couple hours here and there to eat or bathe,"
Talic called out as he walked back to the kitchen.
"He saves time by not bathing, I think."
Cletus picked his teeth with the point of a small knife.
"Good one, Talic."
He looked over at the monk, who was smiling back at him.
"So, how was your first day in Abaddon Hill?"
"Well, I was not evicted by Lord Abaddon, so that was a start." Cletus stopped his cleaning ritual, apparently getting a second wind. He began tearing at a rack of ribs on his plate.
"So, you gonna tell me what you ran into outside of town?"
Aramis knew Cletus hadn't missed his tattered robes when they had returned from the caves outside of town. Cletus didn't ever miss much, if Aramis was correct. Even though he had consulted Father Joris about the Moon Beast, he was not ready to acknowledge the beast as a danger to Abaddon Hill, yet. "We had some trouble with some of the indigenous fauna. We survived." Aramis smiled. Cletus raised an eyebrow, but didn't press the subject. Talic returned to the table, with a nail and a steaming bowl of venison stew for Aramis.
"This is from my latest batch. Did I tell you I brew my own ale here?"
"Yes, Talic, you did." Along with the food, Talic also brought a chair from another table. He sat down and began telling Aramis about a man who lived in southern Inara who could call down rain on a clear day.
"You would pay good money to see that, wouldn't you, Sir Aramis?"
"For Dobbin's sake, Talic, do you actually think a member of the Brotherhood of Aaron would pay to see some charlatan predict the weather?"
Talic turned on Cletus.
"You're just jealous, Cletus. Rules or no, we could make some real money here if the Abaddons just gave me the chance."
"Do us a favor, Talic. Go clean the estates and get them ready for next spring."
Aramis didn't understand Cletus's reference, but it certainly elicited the desired response from the innkeeper. Talic's face turned three shades of red as he stood. Sounds escaped from Talic's mouth, but he was unable to form actual words. Whether it was because he was in the presence of a potential returning customer, or because he feared Cletus's girth, Talic stormed off without saying another word. He did manage to poke his head out of the kitchen long enough to say,
"Sir Aramis, just call out if you need anything."
"At last. Peace."
Aramis allowed himself a smile. "What did you mean by estates?" Cletus finished chewing before answering.
"I hope you didn't mind. You're a new set of ears. You'll be hard-pressed to keep him quiet."
"So I have learned." The gateman continued.
"Talic has a good heart, and you cannot deny his entrepreneurial spirit. But his ideas, for lack of a better phrase,
would suck the life out of a talon tree.
The estates? Cletus held up a bone as a pointer.
Ah, yes, yes. The Avedon Hill estates. Talik got it into his skull that if he only had better accommodations, then merchants and traders that used the pass would stay in town longer. So he built some small one-room homes that he named the Avedon Hill Estates.
Are those the buildings to the east of the inn? Cletus nodded.
Ah, you saw them then. Of course, Talik didn't understand that Avedon Hill is in no way an endpoint for traders. Just a pause on a journey either southeast into the heart of Grosh, or west into the northern cities of Yew. The longer patrons stay here, the longer it is before they can reach their destination and collect or sell their wares.
Cletus had been watching Aramis eat his stew.
You going to eat those dainties?
Aramis shook his head. No, do you want them? Cletus coughed out a laugh and used the sharp end of the bone in his hand to expertly spear the orbs floating in the monk's bowl.
I love me some dainties.
Aramis tried to steer Cletus back to conversation that did not include a discussion of deer testicles. What did Talik mean by rules? Cletus shrugged.
What? That. I'm no businessman, and I don't ever plan on being one. But the Avedons have kept this town afloat because they understand the town's strengths, which aren't many. Guidelines are in place that allow Avedon Hill to play to those strengths, offering services to tradesmen that are only staying a day or two in our town, not wasting the town's resources on foolhardy schemes in an attempt to turn short-term visitors into long-term ones.
Aramis wanted to explore this topic further, but it was Cletus's turn to change the subject.
So has anyone talked to you about the other killings?
Economics completely forgotten, Aramis asked.
What other killings?
Aaron found himself walking down a path overgrown with weeds. The weeds moved, stretched, and receded as if they were living creatures reaching out to touch his ankles. In the distance, they thickened, extending high into the air, obscuring a large building. Tall rock walls. The walls began to crumble, rocks falling away from the structure, crushing the weeds and tree limbs around it. Debris rolled and bounced erratically down the path towards Aaron. Aaron found himself standing in someone's home. He was no longer dressed as Aramis's valet, but as the prince he was. And as in many of his dreams, he wore his grandfather's crown. He also carried the scepter of Yew, which gave him power over life and death through the laws of his land. Aaron looked around and recognized the grand hall of Avedon Manor.
I need to hide. They cannot discover who I am.
Lord Avedon called from behind him.
King Aaron, how good of you to come.
He turned to see Lord Avedon, left arm outstretched. He raised it above his head. Aaron followed the motion. 10 archers looked down from balconies he had not seen, bows drawn. Lord Avedon dropped his arm, and arrows flew at him from all directions. Aaron found himself dressed in his traveling garments. Wildfire began to burn his back, heat exploding through its scabbard and through 2 layers of Aaron's clothing. A pull at a leather strap on his chest and a twist of his shoulder was all it took to bring his sword into reach. He pulled his sword free of its scabbard. Wildfire gleamed as if it had just been lifted from a forge.
Why do you glow? You are not magic.
Even so, Aaron swung it before him, just now noticing his surroundings. He was in a cavern not unlike the cave they had fought in that morning. The dirt and stone beneath his feet began to bubble, transforming into liquid. He jumped away to solid ground, turned to look at the gurgling mass. The light of his sword suddenly became flame. A form began to emerge from the mass. Arms, torso, legs.
The mud around the body fell away, revealing a woman. The woman was a younger Gloria Platt, but with lighter hair, beautiful, yet eyes that held no life. She opened her mouth, and a hiss escaped. Teeth of a vampire. Aaron held his sword between himself and who he could only assume was Greta Platt. Behind him, Aaron heard the growl of a beast. His sword still pointing at Greta, Aaron turned to see a moon beast preparing itself for a leap at Aaron's exposed back. His empty hand was suddenly filled with a burning torch. Did I do that? He turned his body, fiery torch now pointed at the vampire while he kept his sword between himself and the beast. Again, behind him, he heard a new noise, laughter. He craned his head and saw a figure in the distance, floating inches above the ground. He could not make out a face, but from somewhere deep inside, Aaron knew this new figure was the murderer of Greta Platt. The moon beast howled and began its chant. The killer laughed louder as the wolf changed into a giant of a man. Naked, the man reached down and pulled up some dirt. As he rubbed it on his body, it changed, first into a brown, and then into a white nightshirt. Greta Platt moved forward, ignoring the torch between her and her prey. Aaron, unable to stop the undead creature, pushed the torch into her chest. Greta's hiss turned into a scream. She suddenly burst into flames. Aaron focused on Greta's eyes, no longer lifeless. She screamed and fell to the ground at Aramis's feet, burning. The laughter of the killer became louder and more maniacal as Greta fell. Aaron finally noticed the walls of the cavern. They were filled with the glow rocks they had seen in the caves outside of town and at the Avedon's underground cemetery. The rock's glow began to pulse brightly as the undead Greta died once more. Aaron looked over at the shifter, who jumped up and down in apparent glee, staring up at the rocks that glowed more and more brightly. The blade in Aaron's hand abruptly ceased burning, as if the sword had sucked all the flames into itself. The shifter did not attack, instead running from him towards the far wall of the cave. He reached the wall, turned to the side and jumped, bracing one foot against the wall. He then pushed off, gaining even more height, and then disappeared as he landed on the ground, leaving Aaron with the killer. As Aaron turned to face Greta's murderer, a figure appeared behind the killer and struck. A head fell to the ground, rolling towards Aaron. It came to a stop before him, face up. The face was featureless, except for a mouth opened in a dying scream. A yell forced Aaron to look up at the new figure in the cave.
Ha ha! I knew you would be of good use, boy!
Father Joris stood above the headless corpse, delighting in his triumph. There was a flash of light, and Aaron found himself on a horse, riding between John Avedon and Head Constable Lewis.
Aaron, I hope you will return to us to visit. I will one day be lord here, and you will always be welcome.
What about your brothers? Won't they become lord of Avedon Hill before you? Lewis laughed.
They're all dead now, Aaron. Don't you remember anything? No wonder you and Sir Aramis failed.
John Avedon smiled, and Aaron could swear he saw the distinctive teeth of a vampire. With a hiss and a leap, both Constable Lewis and John Avedon landed on top of Aaron, each straining to reach his neck. Aaron Pertee shot up in bed, sweat streaming down his face and back, the sweat mocking Aaron and the bath he had taken just two psychs before. Cletus held up his messy hands in an effort to calm Aramis down.
Not killings in Avedon Hill, but killings nevertheless.
Aramis answered Cletus's previous question.
No one mentioned that anyone had been killed, either inside or outside of town.
Cletus nodded.
In the last few years, there have been several murders, mostly along the roads south and west of town.
How many? Maybe 2 or 3 a year. But that doesn't count the number of people that have gone missing. With those numbers, I'd say it's more like 8 or 9 a year.
Cletus told Aramis what he knew about the murders. People, mostly those traveling alone, were found dead on or near the roads outside of Avedon Hill. Some within a day's travel of the town, others 2 or 3 days' journey by horse. Still others that were frequent users of the Avedon Pass just disappeared, and in some of these instances, wagons were found along the side of the road, horses gone. Sometimes even the goods were found untouched.
The bodies that were found, how were they killed? In most cases where bodies were found, the corpses' heads had been removed. The heads were never found. In a few cases, the heads were left, and bite marks were found on the necks of these victims.
The killer decapitated his or her victims.
Killer or killers, it may just be bandits, and they either leave bite marks or remove heads as a warning, or to enhance their own reputation.
Aramis pressed Cletus.
Just teeth marks, no maulings, like that of a wolf. Nah, not that I have heard.
Aramis clenched his fists for a moment, but then relaxed. Anger served no purpose.
Why didn't Lord Avedon or Constable Lewis tell me about this? In all honesty, they may not even know about all of these deaths. I only know the details because in my position, I hear things from the Grotian patrols that found the bodies, or from those that come asking about missing traders. None of these deaths occurred within a league of Avedon Hill, so Lord Avedon wouldn't be involved at all.
Aramis realized Cletus was correct. The Grotian army, loosely controlled by the Council of Grosh, would not include any local leaders in their investigation of these killings. If the murders were being carried out by bandits, Aramis wouldn't be surprised at all if the Council even condoned these activities. It was possible the traitors weren't paying their taxes and were being punished. Or maybe it was happening because the Council wanted to secretly divert trading guild traffic away from the Avedon Pass. It was not uncommon for the three provinces of Cairn to take steps to keep products from being exported, but murder was not the usual method used to control trade routes. But the appearance of vampire killings and decapitated corpses led Aramis to believe that something other than bandits was at play here.
Tell me something, Cletus. Who in town regularly leaves Avedon Hill for extended periods of time? What do you mean by extended? More than just going out for a picnic at the lake, for example.
Cletus was finally finished with his plate. He attempted to clean his hands with an already messy cloth napkin.
Let's see. Well, Greta certainly before her death, of course. John Avedon for riding competitions or when he hears about a new foal born at one of the better stables in Grosh. Hemming at times. The baker. Yes, he makes supply runs and deliveries to some of the closer towns to our south. Who else?
Cletus wiped off his chin somewhat successfully.
Let's see, Lane Nichols, Constable Ulrich.
Why would the constable need to leave town?
He has family he visits in Southern Grosh at least 2 or 3 times a year.
Images of Lane Nichols flashed in Aramis's mind.
And the librarian. Books, mostly. She meets book traders at appointed times at certain crossroads. Saves travel time for both parties, I guess. In any case, she sometimes leaves with packages, but mostly she just returns with them. She'll travel day or night if it means adding a new item to her collection.
Aramis nodded. Cletus pointed behind Aramis.
Your boy. He doesn't look so good.
Aramis turned to find Aaron walking towards the table. He was still dressed in his sleeping attire. And Aramis could tell that something was not right. Aaron's clothes were drenched. Aramis wondered if he had left a fire in the room burning too hot.
Aaron, are you well?
Aramis figured out why Cletus had sat in the far corner booth of the open tavern area. The booth had been built to accommodate someone as large as him. Cletus patted Aaron on the shoulder as he walked by.
Not sleeping well, boy. I can grab Talik on the way out if you want. Listening to him will put you right to sleep.
Aramis disregarded Cletus's jest.
Thank you for your information, Cletus. I am sure we will see you tomorrow. I'm sure of that as well.
Cletus bowed his head slightly and then exited the inn. Hearing the door shut,
Talik emerged from the kitchen. Aramis waved the innkeeper off in an attempt to keep him from coming to the table. Talik nodded and walked back through the door. Aramis thought he could still see the form of the innkeeper looking at them through the crack of the door. He ignored Talik, pulling Aaron into the booth and pushing his nearly untouched ale into his hands. What happened? Aaron spent the next few moments downing half of the ale from the flagon in his hands.
I had a dream. At least I hope it was just a dream.
Aaron described his dream. As soon as Aaron had mentioned the word dream, Aramis's only desire was for Aaron to talk about what had happened. The Pertee family had a legacy all its own, and it was tied to the world of dreams. Aaron's own mother was the strongest dreamwalker ever seen in the Pertee family, but that was a story for another time. Aaron had not shown any proclivity towards dreamwalking until possibly now. Dreamwalking wasn't about seeing the future. Earlier that day, Aramis had described magic to Aaron as a river, and that certain types of people can interact with that river, priests, sorcerers, even monks such as Aramis himself. Aramis imagined dreamwalkers as those who could walk across a low-hanging bridge that spanned over the widest part of the river, splashed continuously by the spray of the currents below them. While sleeping, dreamwalkers are inundated by images of events, events of the past and of possible futures. And as Aaron whispered about seeing vampires, moon beasts, and of townspeople transformed, Aramis understood that the events that day had somehow triggered some heretofore unseen power within Aaron. The day's events had created something new within Aaron's dreams. And if Aaron was beginning to dreamwalk, it was not that Lord Avedon was going to assassinate him, or that all of John Avedon's brothers were going to die. But it was very possible that some of the elements of Aaron's dream might eventually open up new paths for them during their investigation. As Aramis began considering what these paths might be, the door to the inn swung open, crashing against the wall. The door bounced back and was stopped by a staff held by the man in the doorway, Father Joris. Joris held his holy symbol of Arjun, a dark wood that had been sanded and worked for so many years that the wood shined more like metal than wood. Joris spotted Aramis and Aaron and hurried over to their table.
Tonight, you must sleep.
Joris repeated the sentiments that Aramis had made earlier that night.
But not until I am done with you.
What is it, Joris?
Aramis attempted to prevent irreverence from seeping into his words.
I feel them. They're outside the walls, trying to get in. You must come with me, both of you.
Aramis pointed a finger at Aaron. Go upstairs. I need you rested for tomorrow. A low growl could be heard under Joris's breath.
We need his arm.
Aramis Cragan stood. You have both of mine. They will have to do.
Guys, this isn't quite the end of chapter 13, but it is a good stopping point. Don't want the episode to go too long, so I'm going to end it here. This will be episode 13, part 1. Look for part 2 to be released in just a couple days. And as a separate addendum, this is the first episode where I include a term that isn't explained fully in the audio. The term in this episode was lunas. And check the podcast show notes for more information on this term and any other terms that I might throw out during the podcast that aren't fully explained.
They came from Japan. Robots who were supposed to be entertaining. Robots who were supposed to be harmless. So much for that. From Mark Yoshimaru Nemkov, award-winning author and creator of Shadow Falls and Number One with a Bullet, comes his most off-the-wall audio book yet. Transistor Rodeo. When robots run amok in the city of Los Angeles, something bad is bound to happen. Subscribe today and listen for free at transistorrodeo.podshow.com. Heroes. The very word conjures images of women and men in noble costumes, paragons of virtue, harnessing powers beyond comprehension to fight for justice and defend good against the plots and ravages of evil. Keepsy Branson once dreamed of being a hero, but she and the other members of the so-called third wave of superpowered humans have been judged to have abilities too weak and useless to be formally trained as heroes by the Academy. But as a villainous plot threatens to tear Seventh City apart, what Keepsy and her friends learn is that in a world in which so-called heroes are manufactured by greed and driven more by agenda than principle, true heroism isn't about the strength of your powers or the shine of your costume. True heroes are those who make difficult choices for good with the powers that they have, whatever those may be. Playing for Keeps is the new novel by Murr Lafferty, available for free via podcast in both audio and PDF formats, and now available for purchase in print. For more information, please visit playingforkeepsnovel.com.
Secret Lair, hosted by Chris Johnson and Chris Miller, coming in January 2008. www.thesecretlair.com.
Been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this novel and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through Magnatune.com. Magnatune.com, they are not evil. Additional music generously provided by Kevin MacLeod through his website at incompetech.com. Be sure to check out Murder at Avedon Hill at podiobooks.com, and if you are so inclined, please post a review at iTunes, at Podcast Pickle, or at podiobooks.com. Audio comments about the podcast can be left on the Cairn line at 704-315-5884, or go to pgholyfield.com and click on the Call Me button to leave comments. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008 by P.G. Holyfield and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license.